Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Vanishment, and it is about Judith Dorian's new book of poetry called, well, Vanishment. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about the book Vanishment, Judith Dorian, who wrote it. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Matthew.
Yes. Welcome to the podcast. So I know you through poetry. We were just talking, actually, in the world of the internet and the virtual and the non-real. This is maybe the... I've known you for years, but this is the seventh or eighth time we've actually been in the same space.
Which is incredible.
Yep. Which is incredible and weird and... very 21st century of us to be doing this.
Right.
But one of the things I want to talk about in terms of the book, and we should talk about all the other really interesting things that you've done in your life and are still doing, children's author, piano teacher, writer of the program notes for the Pittsburgh Symphony.
I'm not doing that any longer.
Used to be, but okay. That's kind of amazing. I have to say, you know, this is, of course, an audio podcast. I have a room with a Steinway. I think the first time I've ever been in a room with a Steinway. And it's just your living room.
We'll have to do it another time, so it won't be just the first time.
It won't be just the first time, yes. Which is amazing. And, you know, so historian of music. Well, you are. You know stuff that you have secret knowledge and you're willing to share it with the world. And Vanishment, which is this incredible collection, and I'm not just saying that because I blurbed it, but and my name's somewhere on the book. Or if you Google my name now, your book shows up.
Oh, how nice.
Thank yes, there's you know there's somebody in Australia selling a copy of Vanishment?
No, I didn't.
I did a little vanity surfing, and I put my name into eBay, and there's someone in Australia. There's a copy of Vanishment in Australia for sale.
Now I have another reason to go to Australia.
Yes. Yes. See it before global warming finishes it off.
I would like to.
Yes. But yeah, so this book that has is this incredible collection of poems that, while the theme is vanishment, the poems, that the thing that really struck me about them is that they are about preserving memory.
Yes.
That's... and the experience of memory.
Yes. I would say that's a good summary of what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And which I think is one of the things, you know, we know each other through an online poetry group, and we give feedback, and we meet once a month on Zoom and whatever, is how we know each other. But one of the things I always find fascinating about your poetics is that you recap, like you make the past come alive.
I do spend a lot of time back then.
Yes.
You know, the memories just accumulate, and in a way they enrich the present, and they help to perhaps cover over some of the less pleasant moments of the present.
Mm. Though you do also write about the less pleasant moments of the past, though, which is also...
And there are, unfortunately, a lot of those in general.
Yes. And so, yeah, no, it's, and so there, you know, why should we hear one? Can we just, I like to just dive in and we could talk about it and, and different things.
How about water pours from the pitcher of sky?
Oh,
I lie in bed, dream that the waters rise, soaking sheets, blankets, dream that my little bed floats while the wind rocks the house. And the window opens its mouth in protest. Gulls shoot skyward from the rising waters. Their caws pierce the swollen air. My home, now a tub rank with mold, swallows, regurgitates water that puddles through slats to the floor below. Memories enough to drown in, I stuff into a waterlogged suitcase. You know, that suitcase reminds me of something else. I think it's in here. And it is a poem It's not really my memories. It's trying to envision the memories of other people, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can find it.
There's also, yeah, it is the stuff of life. And memory, like, I think it's always fascinating because I always, some of your poems, when we read them in the group, and certainly I reread Banishment last night to prepare for this.
That's what I should have done.
You know, here's the thing. It's the stuff of life. It's also you produce a work. It's so close. You know, it's like if you work in a restaurant, do you eat in that restaurant on your day off?
Right, of course not. Okay, so Matthew.
Okay. Yes.
I found the poem with the word suitcase in it, the other one. Okay, it's called Third Day March. And I envision this taking place in Ukraine, but it can be, unfortunately, many other places.
Yes.
A suitcase with photos and a change of clothes, few items, heavy with the weight of memories. My home gone, I join others shuffling west towards the blood-red sun, a blister on my heel, filthy stockings torn inside thin-soled shoes. Hands and face unwashed since I left my family 3 days ago, snug in body bags, safe against whistling bombs and machine guns rat-tat-tat. 3 days since I left them stiff in body bags, gripped the railing of the narrow suitcase and fled our building through the open door, half unhinged. Our building, eyeless, where 3 days ago glass panes and lace curtains signaled home. Now exposed, the oak table that my brother Boris made, days old bread and country butter, cabbage soup grown cold, and apples waiting to be sliced. On the upright, still intact, the eighth string quartet of Shostakovich.
Mm.
So many people are in comparable situations.
Yeah.
And I think we need to write about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I talk about him a lot on this podcast. I'm a huge fan of, he passed away in 2017, the sort of British-Polish sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. And he talked about how a lot of his writings were about this way that maybe in the 21st century we're all kind of chronically homeless.
Yes.
You know, he was kicked out of Poland. He was a Polish Jew born in 1925. And so he had to flee Poland twice.
Sure.
And the second time he had to surrender his Polish passport for sort of travel plate papers to be allowed to go somewhere else in Europe. And he realized even in the 1990s that the emotional experiences he had as a refugee were quickly becoming maybe the normal experience for people. Thinking about, you know, what might be coming with political unrest, ecological catastrophe, how many people whose place in the world is so precarious.
Yes.
And as the precariat, as he said, we are the people who live on top of the shifting sands. And how unlike that was maybe for some of our near ancestors.
Oh, yes. I mean,
and so,
we're all nomads, essentially, if not
our
generation, the one before, the one after.
Which is, it's one of the things that draws me to your work. Is that it, you know, we can preserve these memories, preserve these moments in time, preserve these cultural experiences.
Thank you, Matthew. Would you like another one on that?
Yeah, sure. You have such a great voice, and so I'm glad to share it with the world.
Beneath an orange sky. I come from a world on the darker side of now, which my people fled, ran for their lives, and were murdered because, just because. And now I'm here for the ride. I'm here, my friends, I'm here, not there, far from the dark side of now. I'm safe, I'm told, 'cause the ocean's between, the ocean deep and wide. I'm safe, I'm told, 'cause the ocean's between, and I'm here on the sheltering side. But I'm not as safe as I thought I was, though the dreaded camps are gone. There were ashes there are ashes here, and fear still poisons the air. I can live where I please, but I cannot breathe. Ashes stream from the atmosphere. Here streets and alleys shadow the sun. Here mountains and trees phosphoresce. Beneath the glow of an orange sky, I hug the trees that quiver the fires and wonder why they've oranged the sky and made such toxic, awful mess. Ah, well. It's anyone's guess, I guess. Ah, well, it's anyone's guess. As the trembling trees crumble to ash and 1,000 species die, the plant, my friends, is plasticized. The forests are being fried. A tortuous turning to mountains of trash. And I, my friends and I look over our shoulders and wonder why everything we say with a high-pitched cry, everything, toot, has gone awry. I realize so many of these are on such a blue key as opposed to my children's book, which isn't,
but there is a fascinating use of language in your work that I could see. So the children's book is called A Tiny Little Door, that uses that there's a playfulness of language that, well, works for children, you know, that you want in a children, and the musicality of poetic language. And I think for the stuff, though, that you said that has that sort of bluer tone to it, it does give it this very interesting etherealness. And that even... There's a way, even, I think, within your poetry, that memory is itself also this fleeting. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating for me.
Thank you.
Because you can revisit, but you can't stay... And is that revisiting fragmentary and just this temporary, even as we're holding on to something, which is, again, this interesting double bind of the title. You know, it's about things disappearing, but the book itself is a document of preservation.
It's also trying to remember the memories of others.
Mm.
For example, my late husband, may I?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I loved the vanished world from which you came. A world spun across continents, its scar tissue stretched thin, steeped in myth and music, rooted in an empire that shaped the parks and paths where you and Schubert walked and Mahler too, their music heard and dreamed before the wars and after. Music encoded in the inner ear and in the beating of your heart. How could I not love you? Mm. Yeah, he was all music.
Mm. Which also, I mean, you do write about music and context and music and history.
Oh, yeah.
And how also music is itself this very ethereal...
Well, music, I think, of all the arts, can really transport us.
Yeah.
It just does. The sounds alone, the beauty of the music, but it can also bring up memories.
Yeah.
And connect us with memories when you heard a piece of music, or even if it's a piece of music that's new to you, it just does that. And there's something about hearing a piece many times. Schoenberg, Arnold Schoenberg, a 20th century great composer, established a society for music in Vienna, 1918 to 1921. And he had a select audience for who were invited to come, and you paid according to what you could afford. And he very often played a piece of, or had played a piece of music, he had several performers, once or twice or even three times, because he felt hearing something new, especially just once, was insufficient.
Yeah. Which, yeah, the power and the ability of music to, as something that is meant to be performed, even in a recording, there's that still that feeling that those people can, a really good recording, those people are in the room with you and they're alive.
Yes, absolutely.
Is the great punk musician D Boone, who died, actually we're coming up on the 39th anniversary of his death in 1985, and one of his friends and fellow musicians, Henry Rollins, says, you know, if you refuse to believe D Boone is dead, because you could put on those Minutemen records and he's still there. Which is pretty impressive for a set of invisible vibrations.
It's amazing.
To be able to do that. And especially within the world of classical music, which you're very well versed in, it is amazing to think about how a piece can invoke. You live that piece as it's being performed, or as you're hearing this recording, and invoke those maybe same feelings, same mental images, same state of mind all across centuries.
Yes, and it evokes the whole century and the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, the society, which is so different from what we have now. And the interpretation, has somebody interprets, I'll just say, a piece of piano music or an orchestral piece. It makes the piece very, very different. And the instrument on which it's played.
Yeah.
There's so many things to consider.
It almost sort of makes us aware of what the kind of the stuff of life is, or what, you know, what consciousness is, in a strange way. In and of itself is this thing that is fleeting. If you like Eric Fromm, it's always now, right? We're either having or we're being. And in the process of being, you can never hold on to being.
It's always becoming.
It's always becoming, yes. But we also are aware of, and it's the thing I think about with my poetics a lot too, we're also always very aware of the passage of time.
Yes, oh, it's absolutely,
and what we lose,
in your poetry.
Yeah.
In your wonderful writing.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Of course, I can only go back like 20 years in poetry, at this point. I don't like to write about childhood. I guess I go back 40 years or so, but yeah.
I have a few more years on you, Matthew.
Yeah, a couple, yes. Yes, but again, you can open this door. I mean, thinking about a recent piece you brought to the workshop about growing up in the Bronx.
Tremont Avenue.
Tremont Avenue, which, by the way, that poem you have, I think I did it, I don't know if I shared it during the meeting on Zoom, but you wrote about a market on Tremont Avenue in the Bronx.
Yes.
It's probably not the same, but it's still a convenience store, that address. You can still buy food at that address on the first floor of that building on Tremont Avenue in the Bronx. Yes.
Well, there was a whole community, now vanished.
Yeah, Robert, thank you, Robert Moses.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And it ran all the way down to, it was a passageway, actually, I believe, going towards Boston. At some point, it branched, I don't know exactly where, and it was a hill, and it was cobblestone.
Oh, wow.
And there were all the little shops, and children played outside. We didn't have television at that time.
Mm.
I'm giving my age away here.
Yes.
And you went to the rooftop in the summer because nobody had heard of air conditioning, and you
yeah.
tried to cool off. And it was just a very different lifetime. So many different memories and you know, a lifetime that really vanished. Oh, wow.
But we can still have these experiences.
Yes.
We still can still have this. And it's also, you know, this thinking about as I get older, you know, it's like what life, what my life is, like what is the sub, like is there, you know, there's nothing to really hold on to. There's, I guess, stuff that other, I mean, I have some very nice collections in my home, as you do as well. And I guess somebody at some point will have to do something with these things. I think about that a lot. I have nieces and nephews who hopefully understand what rare 1980s punk rock vinyl is worth.
You have to tell them when you start.
You have to tell them, yeah, I'll tell them at Christmas Eve dinner, you know, and like pricing, you know, you can, you know, there's a gold mine here in my dining room. But, you know, we have things, but of course we can't take things with us when we go.
No.
And maybe we don't go anywhere, I don't know, maybe, or somewhere, or something.
So
we don't
what's
know.
The point of accumulating, you begin to wonder? This obsession so many people have with accumulating, and then
yeah.
it goes to somebody else if it survives.
But, you know, you think with every, you know, you have a CD tower there in the corner, and with every one of these books, there still is an experience you can have.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy what I have presently. That is true.
Yes.
But
even that, opening a book is a kind of window into you know, Douglas Copeland we were talking about earlier before I hit record, said, you know, you think you read a novel, you're allowing somebody to hijack your consciousness for a little while.
Right.
And you can think of some imaginary person's problems.
And you can travel in the past or you can travel in the future.
Yes, you can. And one of the things I like about narrative poetry, though, is you can get down to, you know, maybe the essence of someone's life or of an experience.
I think what you're saying is so true, Matthew. I have found that in the groups that I joined in Pittsburgh, I get to know more about the other writers than I ever could if we went to 10 lunches or dinners or whatever, or to a concert. There's so much that is revealed, not in everybody's writing, but even if they're not revealing facts about themselves, even the way they're writing, the way they view things,
yeah.
I really learn what their values are.
Yeah.
If not the events in their lives. And that's one of the things that fascinates me most about the writing workshops.
Mm.
And of course the craft and how you can change something and learn from somebody else. But it's so much about, that's even teaching piano to children. It's not just teaching them to read, to play, whatever. It's their personalities that come through,
oh.
their responses to the music, their excitement about learning, or their non-excitement about learning, you know? I just love that. And the same thing with the poets, only they mostly show it in what they write.
Yes. One of the things that, though, does come up a lot in my, especially poetry workshop classes, is about how the form is a tool of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it a moment ago about your playfulness with language.
Yeah. Which doesn't come through in banishment.
But I think it does. I mean, there are these ways that, like a symphonic piece, there's lines that kind of dance.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wordplay and a sort of paratexis of, you know, flipping of structures and sound structures in your work. That even when you're writing about tragedy, there is this moment of, it feels like I'm listening to, you know, ideas carried on the air.
Now I hear Matthew, the professor, coming through.
Yeah, you can't escape it,
unfortunately. No, I really
value
what you say. I mean, it's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and so when you do that, even in writing about something that's tragic, writing when even, you know, we say never again, but of course it keeps happening again.
Yeah.
But so even when you're chronicling human suffering, there is this, for me anyway, this awareness of, you know, how temporal life is.
Yes. How can it be otherwise?
Yeah. But don't we try? I mean, isn't that part of the accumulation thing?
To hold on.
To hold on.
Yeah. We do. We try. Some are more grasping than others. And it doesn't help.
No. No, it doesn't.
Footprints in the sands of time. You just...
Yeah. And high tide comes along and...
And it's washed away. And that's one thing about works of art, to some extent. Beauty, sadness, history can be preserved
yeah.
by a poem, by a piece of music, by a painting, by a sculpture,
yeah.
by wood carving, mask making, ceramics, whatever it is. That's the record. If it hasn't been destroyed, of
yeah.
what has been, which lasts the longest.
Yeah. I mean, there's those cave paintings. I often think about this purpose of art, or this way of thinking about art. There's those cave paintings in France that from 30,000 years ago.
That's amazing.
And some of those cave paintings are just handprints.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. And isn't that handprint just, I was here, I am somebody?
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is rather existential, isn't it?
Well, whatever label, I mean, it is what some, I think anyone who thinks a lot about, dreams a lot about, well, a lot of people just block everything out because they can't really face
yeah.
how temporal everything is.
Yeah.
But when you say playfulness, for me, there are a few things that really work to keep me out of the gloom and doom for
yeah.
phase of mine. And I love playfulness. I always have. It's a form of creativity, and it expresses itself in so many, many ways.
Yeah, and I think it's also a nice bulwark against maybe our contemporary hyper-technical, hyper-scientific,
absolutely
hyper-economic way of seeing the world.
That is the kind of world I want to vanish. Speaking of vanishing,
yes.
I can't deal with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, playfulness is my refuge.
No. Yeah, so speaking of playfulness, you're also a children's author.
Yes.
Yes. So let's talk about a tiny little door. I forgot an adjective there. So what is A Tiny Little Door?
Well, it's a book that's supposedly for children, but you'd have to define for me what a child is.
Mm.
For me, there is no age limit on childishness.
Mm.
And these poems, they just came to me, so I wrote them down, and here they are. And I'll read you one.
Yes, please do. Please do.
The first one.
Okay.
Noodle Eater. I like noodles made with butter. I like noodles tossed with cheese. When I eat them with black pepper, I at once begin to sneeze. Noodles are a funny word. They make a funny, runny rhyme. Noodle, doodle, and caboodle, yet the taste of them sublime. I like chicken with potatoes. I like chicken from the grill. If I eat some with tomatoes, then I season it with dill. To this dish I add egg noodles, round ones, square ones, short or long, huge or mini, fat or skinny. Noodles never can taste wrong. Mother cooked 3 quarts of squash soup. We ate it cold, we ate it hot. When I went for my 10th helping, there was nothing in the pot. And so I cooked a box of noodles, I ate a bowl and then some more. My bowl piled high, I kept on eating, for clearly noodles I adore. There's a lesson in here somewhere, what it is I've quite forgot. And so I'll keep on eating noodles, cold or frozen, warm or hot.
Mm.
Silly, but fun.
It's silly but fun, but also reminds me of the role of playfulness in all creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about some of the acting training I got as an undergraduate.
Oh, I didn't know, Matthew.
Yeah, it wasn't a big deal, but I did.
Oh,
it
is a big deal.
I used that training a lot in my everyday life. One of the things the director, Kenny Rosinski, used to always say was, you have to get in a mindset. If you're playing Hamlet, no matter how many times how many performances, when that ghost of the father appears, it has to be the first time.
That's wonderful advice.
Yes. And thinking about, like, if childishness is, well, experiencing the wonder of noodles.
Each time,
and in so many different ways, yeah. Of thinking about noodles, which I think as a cynical adult who just keeps getting more cynical. I was a cynical child, too, I think, in a lot of ways. But as a cynical adult, noodles. I gotta make dinner. Butter. You know, these noodles are cold. You know, I think there is a way to... The world wants to maybe grind us into that.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, we go to school and sometimes it's so boring and then the same lessons again and again and you just fall asleep and then you have to do homework and you have your chores and oh, who has time for playfulness?
Yeah, and then comes the world of work.
Like, very hard. It's very hard. And many people really, they have health issues, financial issues that are very serious.
Yeah.
And this is an escape.
This is an escape. But also think about, you know, part of that technical, scientific, you know, it's supposed to be, to use the McDonald's phrase, the same taste everywhere.
Mm.
So how could you be enchanted by a McDonald's french fry?
I could never be enchanted by a McDonald's french fry.
Well, maybe back in the old days when they were still cooked in beef tallow and there was technically more cow in the french fry than was in the hamburger patty.
It might have been enchanting.
It could have been. Maybe the first time. I don't remember my first hit at McDonald's.
No.
I chased that dragon for a few years, but yes.
Yeah.
Would you like to read another piece?
Oh, that's a good idea. Thank
yes.
You. The Illigo Switch. Mind ye, never go down to the Illigo Switch. Never even go near, do you hear? You'll be grabbed and twitted and stuck in a ditch and tossed 40 feet high in the air. But Johnny won't listen. Johnny does as he wishes. And one night with the moon full and bright, Johnny trotted on down to the Illigo Switch, tall as an eagle, a dazzling sight. He danced and he capered and he beat on his drum. Come and get me, he cried. Here I am, do your worst. I'm not scared, do you hear me? Now come, I say come. Do you dare now? He laughed and laughed almost to burst. Then the sky turned bright yellow and chartreuse as the grass. Lightning lit up the world, the earth shook and roared. Thunder rumbled the sky with a terrible blast, and poor Johnny was gone, sucked down deep in the hole. To this day, those brave souls who come close to the sight say that they hear him still beat on his drum, hear him laughing and dancing all day and all night, and one brazen young fellow calls, come, Johnny, come. Mind. Never go down to the Illigo Switch. Never even go near, do you hear? You'll be grabbed and twitted and stuck in a ditch and tossed 40 feet high in the air. So be careful, Matthew.
Well, that's another part of creativity, though, is disobedience.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Disobedience and danger and risk, and whether it's, you know, it's the Lawrence Ferlinghetti thing about poetry, constantly risking absurdity and death.
I was just reading about somebody, a mountain climber, who lost his legs. Mm. And I'm thinking, that doesn't tempt me in the least. I like my dangers sitting home with a cup of tea and writing and imagining the dangers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so much can happen up here, you know?
So much can happen up here. And of course, there is a risk and a danger of performance. There's a risk and a danger of sharing. There's a risk and a danger of, especially, I think for me with poetry, there's a little bit of a thrill of sharing the sort of intimacy of life.
When you mentioned theater, I was thinking of improvisation.
Mm.
I gather what you were working on a few years ago was not improvisation.
No, our director hated improvisation.
Oh, I love improvisation.
Oh, see?
Okay.
But no, this was the risk of being on stage in front of other people.
It's frightening.
It's terrifying.
Yes,
it's terrifying.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Well, you have such a resonant voice.
Thank you.
Did you play the role of Hamlet?
No. The only Shakespeare I was in was I was a non-speaking role.
Oh my goodness.
It was
what a waste of a good voice.
Well, so here's the thing though. I used to have a much smoother Barry White AM radio voice. Mm-hmm. And in those 4 years of doing college theater, I think I got some nodules and some things, and I did see a doctor once, and they were like, well, we could have this like surgery with very long recovery, and you won't be able to speak for a few months. And I said, I can have Fisherman's Friend cough drops anytime I want. And so that's how I get over that. But I was the shadow of Prospero in The Tempest.
Well,
because I had a goatee, and the guy playing Prospero had a goatee.
Yeah.
And whenever he was talking about his history, there was upstage a group of us dressed sort of as mimes who would act out.
Mm.
So that people could, this is what he's talking about, as a way of sort of reinforcing.
At least you didn't have to worry about forgetting lines.
That only happened once. I couldn't do it now. I don't think in my brain I could do it now. But there was one time I was in a play that was a parody. It's the best line I ever delivered because it was so genuine.
What is it?
There's Mr. Putnam. I didn't know what the next thing was. I was playing, it was a parody of Our Town. But it was like Our Town, but everything's kind of sad and dumb and American.
Mm-hmm.
I was turning. I remember the blocking was to turn from this side of the stage to the left side of the stage. And as I'm turning, I thought, what's the next line? What's going to happen? Right. I was the mayor stage manager character for that. So everything went through me. And I went, oh, there's Mr. Putnam. And it was, it was such surprise and relief and joy that I delivered that line.
It sounds so spontaneous. Because
it was so true and spontaneous at that moment, because I genuinely, oh, there's Mr. Putnam. And that's and then the last 15 minutes of the play could happen.
Right.
Or else, yes.
Oh, there's Mr. Putnam. I like that.
Every pianist can hit the wrong note.
Oh, yes. And there
there's so many keys.
So many keys.
Yeah.
And they also have so many different combinations. And
Terrifying.
It is terrifying. Now, if you write something down, you can correct it.
This is true.
You can make a change and nobody is any the wiser.
Yeah.
You don't even need an eraser. Now with a computer, that delete button...
It's gone. It's not even a record of it.
That's right.
Well, I guess you can do versions and undo and clear the cache memory and turn it off, and it's gone forever. But there's still a risk and a danger, though, I think.
Yeah. Well, I know getting up and performing, I mean, I love to do it, and I've done narration, but there is that fear, and you, I guess, have to become so immersed in what you're doing that the fear dissolves and you're just doing it.
The only way out is through. So let's talk about your narration work.
Okay.
Could you explain, like, what?
Well, I narrated a couple of times with orchestra. Peter and the Wolf, that was back in Bedford, PA, under a tent. It was a summer rehearsal. And then a couple of years ago, it was the night before Christmas, with the Edgewood Orchestra. And then a number of years ago, I narrated poetry when Roland Leick was still living, professor of music and composer at Carnegie Mellon, with the Quartetto Latinoamericano, but it wasn't my poetry. It was just a lot of different poetry, from Emily Dickinson to some children's poetry and nonsense poetry, and some he set to music, and some of the music already existed. That was at Mellon Institute, and then, my favorite was Facade, and that is a score with the lyrics written by Edith Sitwell, the poetry written by Edith Sitwell, and the music by William Walton. And they, William Walton for a while stayed with the family in the 1920 or so. And he became friendly with Edith's brother, I think it was Osbert, there were two brothers. And he was out of money, and so he came to stay with the family for a couple of weeks, and it turned into a couple of years. And Edith wrote this marvelous poetry. Mm. It sounds like nonsense. It's an assonance and dissonance, all that sound. Mm. It isn't nonsense, but you have to kind of find the meaning of a lot of it. And it's marvelous. It's with chamber ensemble. Mm. And I performed that at Bedford. I performed it here in a couple of churches and in high school. And you can find many performances on YouTube of all different actors and actresses, some doing the whole thing, some splitting the roles, bits, excerpts, and it's wonderful. You can even hear Edith Sitwell performing, but she reads her work without any expression whatsoever. She just wants the focus on the words. But then you can do anything. It's just a marvelous piece.
Can do anything. And so, speaking of performance as well, and poetry, we will be reading together on January 14th at 7 p.m. in Riverstone Books in Squirrel Hill. There will be a link on the website when I post this to the event page at Riverstone Books. Vanishing and A Tiny Little Door available on Amazon. I will have those links.
Thank you.
Yes. And so now I think it is time. Yeah, it's a good time. For the bottom five. The bottom five are a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. So this is a whole new part of the podcast as we end. Yes, it's terrifying. And so first question, and it's the first question everybody gets their first time on the podcast.
Okay.
If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you like to be?
The least deadly, perhaps the common cold, which is not pleasant, and I don't
It's not pleasant, but it has an impact.
It has an impact, and one can survive it and get comfortable, and you know, you can have a sympathetic, beloved one near you and keep drinking warm tea and lovely
chicken
things.
Noodle soup.
There we are. The noodle soup. That's where the noodle soup comes back. And,
yes, the noodle soup. Which, speaking of vanished experiences, we were talking about this before the podcast. If I had access to a time machine, if you had access to a time machine, there's always time to kill baby Hitler.
Right.
But first, Kazansky's chicken noodle soup in Squirrel Hill.
I think I prefer my own chicken noodles.
Oh, that was See, that was one of the first, like, oh, I'm really living in Pittsburgh experiences when I went into Kozanski's.
Well, I'm not so sure I need to feel that.
You don't know if you need to feel that, no. But for me, that okay. is a deeply nostalgic.
Well, good.
And I lived on Beacon Street for a year, and I just thought, right around the corner of Murray Avenue, and I thought, no matter what,
well, that
I can get a vat of that chicken noodle soup.
It sounds good. It sounds delicious. Probably better than, no, not probably, perhaps better than mine.
See, I was talking to another sort of old head of Pittsburgh who said, no, by the time you got here, it had already declined, and all of their business was just selling six packs to teenagers.
I never had their chicken noodles, so I don't know.
Never.
No, because I always made my own chicken noodles.
Okay.
But, okay, so common cold. That's question one. Question two, and it is sort of related to our main topic, and it's more of a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
When I decided, we were away in the summer, we had to get out of New York City where I grew up, and so my parents would rent a place to stay in some kind of bungalow colony, and somebody gave me a watering can, and I decided that I owned a particular tree, and I watered that tree every day.
Hmm.
Now, that's totally unremarkable, but it gave me so much joy to take care of that tree, and I was sure I was keeping it alive.
Hmm. That's a lovely memory.
Thank you.
All right. Changing gear. Question three. If we were living in a dystopian future, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin, would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? With the caveat, the Bible, the Quran, and the complete works of Shakespeare are already taken. Somebody got those first. Somebody went through the tannery first with those.
I would choose the Haydn Quartets. After all, that's a book too.
Yes.
A volume of music.
Okay.
But that memory of skin is too horrific because it brings me to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
I really can't handle that.
Yeah. Question four. Have you ever had any weird encounters with celebrities?
Yes, but I have to. Can I have some time?
Yes, sure. We can kind of razor blade and compress, or I could tell the story about my student who was selling ice cream at Disney World, and Dennis Hopper got completely furious at her because she did not have change for $100 and could not sell him an ice cream cone. And he went probably full mid-70s. Dennis Hopper berserker rage on her, because maybe if you just go to that souvenir stand over there, they can exchange and I can sell you a $1 ice cream cone, but I do not have $99 in the till, unfortunately.
Would you mind repeating the question?
Sure. Have you had any weird encounters with celebrities?
I don't know if this really qualifies as weird, but I was somewhat enamored of Zubin Mehta.
Mm.
And for 3 months, my husband and I stayed at a place in Jerusalem called the Mishkanot, and there were apartments set up, and there was a celebration for the anniversary of Israel.
Mm.
And I was making St. Peter's fish, which meant I was covered in flour.
Mm.
And each apartment had two entrances, one that led out to a veranda and that overlooked the wall, and then the one that led to the inside corridor where the offices and so forth were. And while I was dreaming about Zubin Mehta, there's a knock at the door, and I open it, and there's Zubin Mehta. And he was looking for the office. He had just arrived. It was a festival. I should have said there was a music festival. And I said, may I show you the way? And that was it. I showed him the way to the corridor.
Wow.
And really angry at myself that I was such a total mess, just covered from head to foot in flour. I don't know if that's weird, but
no, that is strange to be thinking about someone and then encountering that person and in a somewhat compromised state.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Final question. We're almost through this.
Okay.
We're almost out of it.
I think I can manage just one more.
Just one more. What is the worst weather you have ever witnessed or experienced?
Do you mean that metaphorically, or do you mean?
Maybe not metaphorically, but literally, what is the worst weather, worst storm, worst, most unpleasant?
The worst weather I ever had, beyond a doubt, was I was staying or living in a hut, and there was a raging snowstorm, and there was a wolf howling demonically. It was a dream.
Okay. No, that's not good. Yeah, that's definitely not good. Where was the hut in the dream? Did you have a sense of place?
A forest of some kind.
Okay.
It wasn't around here. Well, there are no forests around here.
Yes, we're in Oakland.
Yes. So I don't really know, but it was very frightening, and it was at a very unhappy time in my life.
Mm. So you literally don't have to be Freud to figure that one out. All right. So I think that's about it.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
You're welcome. January 14th at 7 p.m. Riverstone Books in Squirrel Hill, Pennsylvania. And that is January 14th, 2025. Because the internet,
oh, that's right.
That is, the internet is forever. So I always put the year in because...
I get very confused every December because of the change of years. And
the
then I have to remember
years.
To... Yes.
Oh, yeah, and I don't usually write a check out till March or April. And I usually start my checks with 19.
Right.
When
I understand
year, which
that.
Is,
oh, I understand that. Well,
that only worked once
you,
in the 21st century.
Those years have vanished.
Those years have vanished.
Yes.
But can be recalled.
Yes.
And can be re-experienced.
To some extent.
Through art and memory.
Yes.
To a certain extent.
Right.
So and The Vanishing is available on Amazon. It will also be available at the book at the store when we have the reading. And also A Tiny Little Door is also available on the Big Board bookselling website. I will have links for you there. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. This is the second episode I said this, but it will be with the poet John Dorsey. He got bumped. That's all right. It's okay. It's the holidays. It's crazy. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Podcasts. We're All Gonna Die is also on Facebook, and maybe I'll open a Blue Sky or something. I don't know. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been a delight.
It has been a delight.
So happy to have you in my home finally.
Yes, after visiting it on Zoom so many times.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And thank you to Andrew Fox for our lovely theme music. Later, Meets. 2, 3, 4!